Marriage Today presents The Four Foundational Laws of Marriage by Jimmy Evans.
One of the most important things that we understand related to marriage is there are laws. And a lot of times people are fearful of marriage because they don't understand that there are laws associated with it. Now, I'm a pilot. I'm a licensed pilot. I got my pilot's license last year. My family will not fly with me yet. I mean, let me give that disclaimer. But there are laws related to aerodynamics, and so I'm not afraid to fly as long as I'm respecting the laws, because there are laws. Planes don't just fall out of the air. Is that, you know, when there's a plane that crashes or something that happens wrong, it just didn't happen, you know, just by chance. It's something violated the laws of aerodynamics for that to happen. I say, when you don't understand the laws of marriage, it's a really scary thing. And it was for Karen and me. We got married at 19 years old. We didn't have any pre-marriage preparation before we got married, and so we didn't know. And honestly, I just thought, you're either lucky enough to marry the right person, or you're unlucky and you marry the wrong person. And honestly, I loved Karen. I was very attracted to her. But I thought I married the wrong person after a few years of marriage, and she did too, because it just wasn't working. We didn't know. No one ever told us. We were violating every law of marriage. And so some of you watching right now, you love each other and God put you together, but you may be frustrated, you may be discouraged, you may be fearful because you've failed before in marriages, or you feel like you're failing now and you don't know what to do. I just want to give you the good news. When God creates anything, He creates it for success. And when God creates anything, He creates it upon the laws of His kingdom and the laws of His word. So when God created marriage, He said some very important words. And this is Genesis 2, 24 and 25. You probably heard this before. It says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed." Now, I'd heard that scripture read, and I'd heard it at marriages and at weddings and things like that, but I never knew that those were the four foundational laws of marriage. And that everything, God created marriage and He spoke those words. And when He spoke those words, He created a foundation for marriage that would ensure that every marriage could succeed. Now, listen to what I'm about to say. You have a 100% chance of success in marriage. You were made for marriage. God made you in your mother's womb and you were made for marriage. And some people just think, I don't know that I can succeed in marriage. You know, I'm fearful of marriage. I have a 50-50 chance. You don't have a 50-50 chance. You have a 100% chance if you do it God's way. Let me tell you the other good news. It's not complicated. If it was complicated, I couldn't do it. God doesn't use me to do this because I'm special. God uses me to do this because if I can do it, anybody can do it. It's simple. There are four foundational laws of marriage, and once we understand these laws and just apply these laws, it changes everything. And it did for Karen and me. We were on the brink of divorce. We didn't know anything about marriage. But once we began to practice the four foundational laws of marriage, first of all, it tells you what to do. Secondly, when you start having problems, it tells you we're having problems because we're violating one of these laws of marriage. So the first law of marriage is the law of priority. And we'll go through these four laws. The Bible says, "For this cause, a man shall leave his father and his mother." The word "leave" there doesn't mean you mistreat your father or mother. It just means you reprioritize. Before you get married, they're your closest blood kin. Before you marry, if it came down to it, they're the most important priority in your life. But what it says is, for this cause, not for every cause, but for this cause, you've got to reprioritize your relationship. And don't be mean to your mom and dad. Don't, you know, do anything unbecoming. But you've got to reprioritize, and now your spouse becomes first. Listen, marriage only works in first place. It won't work in any other place. And so we have to reprioritize our lives and able to do this. Now, let me talk about legitimate jealousy for just a minute, because there is a bad kind of jealousy, but when we get married, there is a natural jealousy that is inside of us that God puts there. Let me give you an example of this. We have two children. Our children are in their 30s, and when our daughter Julie was born, we got married at 19, and Julie was born when we were 20. And about 12 months after we got married, just y'all doing the math. And Julie was born, and she was born. I had not held her. That was before the days that guys went into the room when babies were being birthed. So I was waiting outside. Julie was born, and they took her into where they, you know, cleaned her off and measured her and all those things. And so I had never held Julie. I had just, you know, obviously Karen was pregnant, and then when she was laying in this little room with these nurses, I was looking in the window at her, and one of the nurses walked up and grabbed her by the heels, you know how they do to measure them, and she just grabbed her by her heels and just hung her by her heels to measure her. I almost went through the plate glass window. I mean, literally, my body just said, jump through there and rescue her. That woman was, you know, handled like a sack of taters, you know, and so it frightened me. Well, what I realized was the instant that my daughter was born, I became a protective father. I never read a book about it. Nothing ever told me I was supposed to do that. It was instinctive. When you stand at the altar and get married, or you get married, something, God places something inside of you that says, you belong to me first. Before your parents, before your friends, before the kids, before your work, before athletics, you belong to me first. It happens with both of us. And so remember, in Exodus 34, 14, God says, my name is jealous. God, one of the names of God in the Bible is capital J, jealous. And jealous means intolerant of rivalry. God is not sick jealous. He is passionate jealous. God loves us and He fights for the relationship. And God resents anything in our life that has taken His place, because God deserves first place, right? Okay, so God wants first place. He believes that He deserves first place, and He does. So when God sees us giving His place to somebody else, God becomes jealous. Again, not out of an emotional unhealth, but out of passion. I'm thankful that I serve a God who loves me and fights for the relationship. I am. Okay. But in marriage, you naturally will become jealous when something has taken your place in your spouse's life. They did a study of couples, and they found, and this is not a good study, this was just, but it was a real study. And they found that couples that first get married, you hear about the honeymoon being over, they're the happiest. And this is a secular survey. Shouldn't be that way, but they are. And the reason is nothing has happened in the beginning of the marriage to upset the priorities of the marriage. But when children come into the marriage, the satisfaction of the marriage typically drops. Again, there's nothing wrong with kids. Kids are a blessing. But when children come into the marriage, what typically happens is a man turns his attention more to his career, a woman turns her attention more to the children, and the priority of the marriage is lost. When children enter into secondary education, junior high and high school, marriage satisfaction is typically at its lowest. And that is because the kids are active, they need a chauffeur, they're socially active, and they need a lot of attention, and they need a lot of money. And once again, they do. And so there's pressure on the father, there's pressure on the mother, and again, they're not spending time together. Once the kids leave home, when they're 18, 19, 38, once they leave home, the marriage satisfaction goes up, typically at that point. But unfortunately, never as much as it was before. And let me tell you the sad part about that is God made marriage to get better every year. God never makes anything to fail. How sick is it that the rookie is supposed to be the best? Is there any other area of life where the rookie is supposed to be the example? And what a terrible thing to say is, oh, how long have you been married? Well, we've been married 10 years. Oh, the honeymoon's over. Well, now you got a lifetime of drudgery ahead of you. Good luck, you know. Marriage gets better when you do it God's way. And it only works in first place. It won't work in third or fourth place. Believe me, I tried. And so here's how to establish and maintain the right priorities in your marriage. There's two steps. One is they have to be proven in real terms, not just words. You can't just say you're first in my life. You have to prove that your spouse is first in your life. And here are four ways that you prove your priorities in marriage. They're very simple. One is sacrifice. What will you give up for me? It's real simple. What will you give? Golf, and golf is of the Lord, is that golf almost ruined our marriage, because Karen, early in our marriage, I golfed all the time. Karen wanted me to give up golf. I told her, I said, no, but you can come caddy for me. It was a near-death experience. I saw the white light, the whole thing. And is that I wouldn't give up golf for her, but I didn't understand why she was so upset. What will you give up for me? Now, I want you to listen to me just a minute. Now, the second one is time. Sacrifice, what will you give up for me? The second one is time, consistent with priority. If you're telling me that I'm first, there has to be time. Time is the commodity of relationship. Money is the commodity of business. If I wanted to keep you from being successful in business, I just have to keep you away from money. If I can keep money from you, you'll never succeed in business because money is the essential commodity of business. Time is the essential commodity of relationship. To ruin your relationships, all I have to do is keep time away from you. And there's the old saying, if the devil can't get in front of you and stop you, he'll get behind you and push you too fast. And people are going too fast. And they don't have time for family. They don't have time for each other. And we have to cut back. What will you give up for me and how much time are you going to give me? Let me say this. When Karen and I got married, there weren't cell phones. There weren't computers. There weren't fax machines. There weren't cars. We had cars back then. But listen, there weren't computers and cell phones and all that. So when you were with a person, you were with that person. If you were on a date and you were like eating dinner, it was just you. No one else was with you. Today, we have so much electronic intrusion into our lives. And when you're dating, here's what happens. When you're dating, your phone rings and you look at it and turn it off. Whoever's calling you, you turn it off because it's like, sorry, someone's trying to get a hold of me, but you're more important. You're more important. I'm going to sacrifice talking to my friend because of you. When you're married, you take the call. And what happens is, sometimes it's okay. Sometimes you're together and it's a casual getting together. But I'm telling you, there's sometimes I'm with Karen, I don't want her talking on her telephone. And she doesn't want me talking on my telephone. And what this means is I'm going to sacrifice being connected to everybody on earth for as long as it takes for us to bond. And let me say something. Electronics are great, and I believe in technology. It's a good servant, but it's a terrible master. It will destroy your relationships if you don't discipline it. It will destroy your relationships. And let me say another thing. They have proven electronic relationships are not as quality as flesh, as face-to-face relationships. And so when I'm with my wife, she belongs to me first. I belong to her first. And I'm going to say no to people who are trying to intrude on this so we can have a conversation without it constantly being interrupted or something like that. Now, you know, there may be an exception of the kids are home and the house is on fire, something like that. You go ahead and take the call, you know. But number two, so you have to prove your priorities. By the way, the four ways you prove your priorities: sacrifice, time, energy, and attitude. There has to be energy. It can't just be your home eating chicken, watching sports. You know, there has to be some energy behind it and an attitude. The attitude is, I want to be with you. This, you know, you're not a ball and chain. I really want to be with you, and it's good. The second way that you prove priorities is you have to constantly protect them from good things out of priority. Good things out of priority. Most of the things that destroy marriages aren't bad things. They're good things out of priority. Let me give you an example. When I went into the ministry, Karen and I had a real problem early in our marriage with golf, work and golf. And I hung up my golf clubs for several years and it healed our marriage. Because what it communicated to Karen is, she was first in my life. And I gave her then the time that golf was taking from her. And now she doesn't mind if I play golf because she knows that she comes first. But when I came into the ministry, I was in business before I came into the ministry. The Lord healed our marriage. People started coming to us for marriage counseling. The pastor of our church walked up to me and said, would you come on staff to do marriage counseling? I was shocked because I didn't feel qualified. I'd never had any formal training in that. But I came on staff to do marriage counseling, and then 10 months later, he left to take a church in Florida, and I became the senior pastor of our church at 29 years old. I was terrified. I didn't know how to preach a sermon. I didn't know how to do a funeral or a wedding. I didn't know how to manage a staff. Our church was 900 people at that time. And I had no experience. And I had no friends in the ministry. All my friends were in the appliance business. They were worthless at that point in time. You know what I mean? Hey, Bob, how do you pastor somebody, you know? I was in ministry, didn't have any friends in ministry, 29 years old. And I was obsessed. Well, I had fear of failure, fear of rejection. All those things were motivating me. And I worked too much. And when I came home, Karen's the best wife in the world, and she was totally supportive of me being in ministry and pastoring and all that. But I would come home after 12 or 14-hour days, and when I came home, again, Karen's a great wife, but she would say, Brent needs this, Julie needs this, I need this. And that's not what I wanted to hear. What I wanted to hear when I came home is, thank you for saving the world from evil. And you're... You're the greatest man on earth, and come in. You don't have to lift a finger. We're going to do everything for you. But she didn't do that. Julie needs this, Brent needs this, and I need this. And he's like, I'm tired. And she said, I know you're tired. But Julie needs this, Brent needs this, and I need this. And so we got in a fight over it. And I just thought, she's persecuting the Lord's anointed. And I did. That's what I thought. I just thought that. So I told her that, by the way. Well, we got in a fight. We got in a big fight over it. And I decided I'm sleeping on the couch. I'm not going to let the sister have the blessing of me being in bed with her. And I think she slept better, actually. Honestly. I slept on the couch for several nights. I knew she was wrong. I knew she was wrong. No doubt in my mind she was wrong. And I was laying there one night, sanctimoniously, and I was laying there, third night on the couch, and I was praying for her. And I thought, Lord, help her. You know, she... Here's what the Lord spoke to me. I'll never forget it. Spoke to my heart. Jimmy, you have communicated to Karen in real terms that the church is more important than she is. Now you repent, and you go tell her you're wrong. And I thought, you mean I've spent three nights on the couch to hear that? And I went and I told Karen, I said, Karen, I'm full of fear. I'm driven. I'm giving everything to the church. And I said, I'm so sorry. And I said, I'm going to leave the ministry. I'll go back in the appliance business. We'll get our lives right. And Karen said, Jimmy, you're supposed to be in the ministry. Don't leave the ministry. But we need you first. And from that point forward, I changed. Because I decided I wasn't going to lay my family on the altar of success. And let me say this, because, you know, all the pastors, these wonderful pastors there, sometimes we get confused between God and church. The most important thing in my life is God, but that's my personal relationship with God. That's not church. The second most important thing in my life is my wife. The third is my children. The fourth is in church and extended family and work. It comes all the way down here. And like I said before, a lot of times the things that are threatening our relationship aren't bad things. They're good things out of priority. Children. Nothing is as important, God in a marriage, children. But some people say, well, my children, you know, I live for my children. That's good. But listen, your children are a temporary assignment. They come and go. Listen, I remember when they put our kids in our hands, and I remember when we gave them away at their weddings. And they don't want you following around the rest of their life. They want to be in relationship. But listen, when you give your marriage up for your children, how are your children going to succeed in marriage if you don't show them how? And the number one thing they need to see is you prioritizing your marriage. I want to say something to blended families, because I know probably half of you guys are blended families. A lot of people watching are blended families. In an intact nuclear family, you have a marriage and then children. It doesn't mean there aren't challenges there, because there are, but you have a marriage and then you have children. In a blended family, you have children than a marriage. Families don't build around children. They build around a marriage. Marriage is the nucleus of that. And I want to say, if you're in a blended family, the number one issue in succeeding as a blended family is making your marriage first. And sometimes children are hurt. There might have been a previous marriage. There might be loyalty to a biological parent. And there may be animosity, even hostility, toward the non-biological parent or whatever, which creates confused emotions and all of that. I want to say this one more time. If your children have been through a bad circumstance and they've seen a failed marriage, the best thing you can do for your children is show them how to succeed in marriage and say to them, honey, I love you. There's nothing more important in my life than God and my husband, and I love you too. But my priority is the marriage. And we're going to have a strong marriage, and we're going to be a united front. And as a united front and as a couple, we're going to parent you. And I'm going to talk more about this in just a minute about blended families. But the marriage comes first. I'll say this. There may be misunderstanding, but the parents need to be the parents. There may be misunderstanding or difficulty or whatever. Your marriage has to come first. And in a blended family, it's not the exception. You have to put your marriage at the core of the relationship, and then the children relate around the marriage, not the other way. Otherwise, you become divided. The number one law of marriage is the law of priority. It only works in first place. Let me say this. It's a challenge, and some of you may be violating that law, and your spouse is complaining. They feel jealous. And they're complaining about your work. They're complaining about the kids. They're complaining about this or that. Not bad things, just good things out of priority. What your spouse needs to hear from you in real terms is, I'll make any changes in my life I need to make. But except for Jesus Christ, you are the priority in my life. It's not a principle that's for a few. It's a law. It's the only way that marriage works. Number two, law of marriage is the law of pursuit. A man shall cleave to his wife. Marriage is work. Is you have to work at it. It's some, you know, some people, a lot of people have misconceptions about marriage. When it says a man shall cleave unto his wife, the word cleave there means to pursue with all energy. It means to cling on to. It's an energetic word. And so from the very beginning, God told us marriage is work. You have to work at it. You know, when you fall in love, you work at the relationship. When I was 16 years old, I asked Karen out. We were 16 years old. We went to elementary and junior high school together, but we didn't know each other. In high school, we started dating when I invited her to a Three Dog Night concert. And 1969 or so. I had a 1969 Dynamic 88 Oldsmobile that my mother wrecked and gave to me. She did that with all my brothers. She wrecked a car and gave us the car that she wrecked and got herself a new one. And I worked a scrub-a-dub car wash when I asked Karen out. And I had hair down to here and, you know, I was kind of a hood and everything. So I asked her out. But when I asked her out, I remember that I just knocked myself out before I picked her up. I washed my car that day, and I pulled up. I always pulled up on the good side of the car. It was months before she knew my car was wrecked because I always pulled up on the good side of the car. And I just knocked myself out to be mannerly. You know, those were the days that you drove well. And, you know, I drive just real carefully. If we hit a little bump, I'd say, are you okay? You know, 5 minutes later, we hit a bar ditch. I'd say, toughen up. Stop griping. You know, and it's just the way that it is back then. So I would just work, work, work. But as soon as I knew that I had her, I began to take her for granted. And that's human nature. We work until we get something secured, then we take it for granted. Well, that's why marriage doesn't work. Today, we work at our marriage, and our marriage is great as long as we work at it. It's never different than that. No one is the exception to this, but a lot of people have misconceptions related to marriage, and we have to get these misconceptions out of our mind. The first is, if I marry the right person, the emotions will happen naturally and effortlessly throughout our marriage. If I marry the right person, the emotions will just always be there. Every morning, I'm going to wake up and look at you and just go, hallelujah. Oh. It's happening again. You know, you're going to open your eyes and smell their breath and, you know, see them in the harsh morning light. And there's no such thing. Now, listen why this is so important. Because there are a lot of people that believe there's something wrong if I have to work at it. If I married my soulmate, and this is the word that's being used a lot today, soulmate. I'm looking for my soulmate. Let me tell you something about your soulmate. A, they're really messed up. Okay. If you think your soulmate is this person that you see and you just go, oh, like that. Well, you may fall in love with them, but they're still messed up. Let me tell you another thing about soulmates. They're not born, they're made. The best marriages are not two perfect people who get together and chemistry strikes and they live happily ever after. The best marriages are two very different people who have a lot of incompatibility that roll up their sleeves and go through lots of trouble together, but they stay together and work it out and they come out as best friends. That's how marriage works. The best marriages are people who have high goals and a high work ethic. The worst marriages are people who have high goals and not a good work ethic. That's proven in research. And so if I marry the right person, the emotions will be there. No, they won't. It'll be there to the degree that you work at it. And even if you work at it, there'll be times the emotions just aren't there. The second is, if my emotions change toward my spouse, I must have married the wrong person. No. Again, emotions come and go. I can't predict my emotions, but the best love in the world is love by choice. It's called agape love. It's God's type of love. I don't know what my emotions are going to do tomorrow, but I'm always in control of my will. When I say I love Karen Evans, what I'm saying is this: regardless of how I feel or what she does, I've made a decision. I will always be faithful to her and do my best to love her as Jesus would. That's what I'm saying. I've made a decision. I can't depend on emotions. The most beautiful people in the world, the most talented people in the world, you notice they fall in love, they divorce. They fall in love, they divorce. Why? Because they think if my feelings change, I've got to change spouses. There's something wrong with this. No, if your feelings change, you just work. There's the grass is greener syndrome. You know, it's when the grass looks greener on the other side. And that's what the devil wants to do, whether it's someone across the street or somebody at work or someone real or imagined. You know, the grass always looks greener on the other side. And there's two sayings that I like. One is, when the grass looks greener on the other side, it's time to water your own yard. And here's another good one. The reason the grass looks greener on the other side is because you can't see the poop from here. Everybody looks good from a distance, you know? But live with them for a while. And then you'll see that it's not as good as you thought it was. Everybody looks good from a distance, but when you have to live with that individual, then you see all their issues up front. Let me say, that's when you know, my best friends are not the people who love me in the good times. My best friends are the people who know all the dirt and still love me anyway.
That's right.
Right? And those are the kind of friends you want. Karen and I have been together for a long time. I think we've seen everything, but maybe we haven't. But I can tell you this, we're still together. And that's what love is. It's not the emotion. And we believe that we married the wrong person, but we stuck it out. And we know that God put us together. Number three, misconception of love and romance. Positive events, experiences, and actions should fuel the relationships and our emotions long term. In other words, if we take a trip to Hawaii or if we have a big Valentine's weekend or whatever, that's going to last for a long time. And that's not true. Marriage operates on the manna principle. The children of Israel woke up every morning when they were in the wilderness, and for 40 years, every day manna was there, and God said, you can't accumulate it. You can only pick up one day's worth, except before the Sabbath, you can pick up 2 days' worth. He said, but you have to pick it up every day. First thing they did is the Israelites went out and took all they could and put it in their tents. You know, and what happened, it says, it bred worms and stank. They were trying to accumulate it, and God says, no, I want you to learn to relate to me every day and trust me every day. A relationship with Jesus is an everyday thing, not an every month thing or an every year thing. Love is a perishable commodity. Yesterday's love is worthless. It has to be renewed every single day. It doesn't matter what your emotions were a year ago. I'm telling you, I've been a Christian for 40 years, and I'm just telling you right now, if I go 3 or 4 days without praying and reading the Bible, it changes. I mean, God doesn't change, but it changes me. I've got to have a daily relationship with God. The love and the passion that I have for God, it has to be something that's expressed daily, not monthly, not annually. Same is true with Karen. Marriage is a daily thing that we need to love each other every day. Now, this men are the worst. Women kind of get that. But men are the worst related to this because men think in terms of points. You know, how many points do I have in the bank? And I'm in trouble, so how can I accumulate some big points in a hurry to get out of trouble? And men and points. So here are how men kind of think about points. Here are the big points for men. Date, that's good points. Flowers, always a winner. Card, jewelry. Jewelry's big, 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 big. Housework, trip, giving up a sporting event, taking care of the kids, going shopping with her. The ultimate now is going to a girl movie where there's no killing. And that's the ultimate, like that. You know you're in love when you're willing to do that. I went to see The Horse Whisperer with Karen, and I just thought I was going to die. I really did. But the some men say that point system. Yeah, great. Okay, here's the way it works. So you take her on a trip, you know, you do something big for her, and you're thinking, man, that was big. That cost a lot of money. That's going to last for a long time. All points evaporate at midnight every night. Jewelry lasts maybe 2 to 3 days. And that's the biggest of all. And you're just thinking, man, I am Don Juan. I took her out on this big date. I did this and this and this. And boy, do I have some big points. And so you wake up the next morning, she's just kind of hanging over your bed. You're saying, hey, good morning. Hello. Well, honey, good morning. I mean, what about our trip to Hawaii? What? Get up. You're just thinking, my gosh, I did all that yesterday. That was yesterday. What are you going to do today? It's an everyday. They don't accumulate. I'm just telling you right now, marriage is an everyday deal. It doesn't matter what you did yesterday. What are you going to do today? Every single day. And again, we have the tendency to want to accumulate points so that we can, you know, ride those for 2 or 3 months while we're out checked out doing something else. Marriage is an everyday thing. And here's another misconception. When we have no emotions or have fallen out of love, there is no way to get the love back. Well, there is. In Revelation chapter 3, God says to the church at Ephesus that has fallen out of love with Him, remember where you fell from, repent, and do the deeds you did at first. When Karen and I fell out of love, the way we fell back in love was very simple. We didn't have any emotions. We didn't like each other. We thought that we had made a mistake, and we were both very scarred in our marriage. But we began to do what we did when we first fell in love. We began to pursue each other. I told her I was sorry. I hung up my golf clubs. We made each other first. We began to be together and work at the relationship. Let me say this. Within several weeks, we were more in love than we'd ever been before. It didn't take forever. Some people say they're out of love. I understand. We had no emotion in our relationship except for negative emotion. Several weeks later, we were passionate about each other. Now listen to me. When you start violating the laws of marriage, the devil always comes in to tell you that you made a mistake and the only answer is to divorce and all that. All you have to do is put each other first and start working at it. And you'll get the love back. Let me go to the third law of marriage. The third law of marriage is the law of possession. And that means God created marriage to share everything. He says they too shall become one flesh. For this cause a man shall reprioritize his life and his parents. Now, they're not going to be first any longer. And he's going to work hard to pursue his spouse. And by the way, that's addressed to men there, working hard to pursue your wife. And they too shall become one flesh. And what this means is we share everything in this marriage. And this is going to sound like kind of a simplistic statement. Marriage is about sharing. It doesn't matter if you have kids in common. It doesn't matter if you share the same house. It doesn't matter if you share a checkbook. Do you share a life? Marriage is about sharing. And when the Bible uses the term for intimacy in marriage, it says one. Now here's what this means. Everything before you got married that you owned and administrated individually, now you do it together with no exceptions. It's our money, it's our time, it's our children, even from a blended family. And let me say this, one of the most important things in blended families is giving your spouse ownership of the children. And I'll say something else about that in just a minute. They may not be the biological parent, but they have to have full ownership. Anything that I will not give to you going into the relationship will create problems in our marriage. In fact, it creates jealousy, just the way that I said before. But here's the way that people violate the law of possession. One is dominance. Some people, and it's very common, in most marriages, there's a dominant partner, in most marriages. But dominance destroys the passion and intimacy of marriage. Men and women are totally equals in every way. Karen and I never discuss who the boss in our marriage is because Jesus Christ is the boss of our marriage. And we were totally equals. But when we first got married, I was dominant. You can be dominant through the force of your personality. You can be dominant through intimidation. In other words, you're going to pay a price if you cross me. You're going to pay a price if you speak your mind. You can be dominant through manipulation. But dominance is as common for men as it is women, and women as it is men. It's not a male issue or a female issue. It's a gender-neutral issue. But dominance simply means I'm not going to share. It's mine. Basically, it's mine. And I'm going to control it. It's my kids, my money, my house, my schedule, whatever it is. And so, but it's always destructive. They've done studies on dominance, and it's always proven where you have dominance present in a relationship, and to the degree that you have dominance present, it lowers the satisfaction of the marriage because there's one spouse being dominated. They're not an equal. They're not sharing. They're being controlled, basically. Another problem with the law of possession is independence, is that I'm just going to do my own thing. I counseled a couple one time, and she said, well, he goes to that side of the house, and I go to this side of the house. And she said, I sit over here all night, and he sits over there all night in his office gambling. And she said, that's our marriage right there in a nutshell. And she had done everything she could to try to reach out to him. And I told him, I just said, you know, marriage is about sharing. And he was independent. And marriage is brutal on selfish people. Marriage is not about independence. Marriage is about interdependence. If you want to be independent, stay single. But even if you're single, you're not independent. You need God. We're dependent upon God. Independence and selfishness destroys a marriage. Interdependence. I need you. I didn't get married so I could live alone on that side of the house. I got married so I could share my life with someone. Another problem with the law of possession is protection. And let me go back to the blended family issue just a minute. I've counseled a lot of blended families where they get together and there's children from a previous marriage. Maybe they didn't want the marriage. Maybe they don't trust the spouse or whatever. I counseled one couple in particular. He had no authority over the kids. And it's typically better, especially when the family is new, when the marriage is new, if the biological parent does the discipline. That's typically better. It just makes sense that if, you know, they're my biological children, I'll do the discipline. But the non-biological parent has to have full authority to discipline if necessary and to protect themselves. And some people say, listen, you know, they've been through a hard time and I just don't want to do that. In fact, one woman said to me, I don't trust him with the kids. And I said, in other words, you trusted him with your life to marry him, but you don't trust him with your children. And what happened was he was in the home and he was a fair target. These kids were coming after him every day with actions and words that was ruining the quality of his life. And he said, I can't take it anymore. And I turned to her and I said, listen, he's got to have ownership of your children. And she said, I won't. There are no exceptions to this. And this is an interesting scripture. This is 1 Corinthians 7. It says, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. This is so profound that the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 is saying, when you get married, you actually give authority sexually of your body over to your spouse. This is not a license for abuse. This is just a license for use. And what this ensures is the fact that I'm not going to use my body against you or as a weapon or as a bargaining chip. This is not my body. This is your body to take care of your needs. And that is the spirit of marriage, the way God designed it. They too shall become one flesh. And protection. I'm not going to protect the kids from you. I'm not going to protect the money from you. We're partners. We're going to make all of our decisions together. You establish the law of possession in your marriage by asking your spouse's input on every decision and never making a decision without your spouse. And never making your spouse pay a price for telling you the truth. The spirit of a good marriage is we're partners here. We may be different. We may have different money languages. We may have different needs. We may have different perspectives. But that just makes us better. That just makes us stronger. I'm not going to make a decision without your input. And our relationship is more important than the issues. We share everything. It's the word my destroys marriages. It's our. It's our children. It's our schedule. It's our home. It's our money. Prenuptial agreements are a death sentence to a relationship. A prenuptial agreement basically just says, I'm not going to give you this. I don't trust you with this. And if we divorce, I don't want to lose the aquarium and my Volkswagen. And the aquarium and the Volkswagen then become this despised object in the home that your spouse knows. They love that more than they love me. You say, well, what if we get a divorce? It's going to hurt really bad and you're going to lose a lot. So you better work at your marriage. Listen, is it any surprise that things end badly when you've planned the end from the beginning? When you get married, we say these words, till death do us part. We're going to work hard at our relationship and we're going to learn about marriage because this is till death do us part. We're going to be happy or we're going to be two old, miserable people. But we're not getting out of this thing. We're going to stay committed to it. There's one of the law of marriage, it's the law of purity. It says, the man and his wife were both naked and unashamed. And this is before the fall. This is before sin entered the Garden of Eden. Isn't it wonderful that God, by the way, the word Eden means pleasure and delight. God created marriage in a place that means pleasure and delight. And he created Adam and Eve naked. Isn't that phenomenal? Isn't that just great? They were naked. I mean, you think about how God created marriage. It was great. And so they were naked until the fall. And you remember after the fall, the first thing that happened is they put on fig leaves and they began to hide from each other. Now listen, they put the fig leaves on their genitals, which are the areas where you're different and you're most sensitive. Those are the most sensitive areas of your body. What's the point? When you're living your marriage in purity, you can expose your differences and you can talk about all the sensitive areas of your marriage without a problem. But when you have sin in your marriage and you're sinning against each other, you cannot trust each other and you have to hide your differences and your sensitivities. When Karen and I got married, I was verbally abusive and dominant. And I didn't know my wife. I didn't know I didn't know my wife, but you know, I had so hurt her through the things that I had said that she was covered with fig leaves. I mean, literally, she wasn't gonna tell me about the sensitive areas of her life because, you know, when I got mad, I would take advantage of it. And I was just insensitive. When I repented in living in purity, the law of purity just simply means this: I have to be careful about what I do because everything I do affects you. And when I make a mistake, I have to take responsibility for it. Those are two things I didn't do. I wasn't careful, and I'd never said I was sorry. And I didn't know my wife. We didn't have intimacy. We had sex. She was good about meeting my sexual needs, but we didn't have any intimacy in sex because we didn't know each other. We didn't talk on any deep level. I went to Karen, and I asked her for her forgiveness when I hung my golf clubs up and when the Lord began to change my heart. I asked for her forgiveness, and she forgave me. And she said, "Jimmy, you really wounded me with your mouth." And I said, "I understand that, Karen." I said, "I'm sorry, and I ask you for forgive me." And so the fig leaf started coming off her. And she began, it didn't happen overnight, but, you know, after several weeks and several months, I noticed that she began to tell me things that I didn't know. And one day she was talking to me, and she told me something, and I said, "Well, how long has that been going on?" She said, "Well, years." And I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me that before?" And she said, "I couldn't trust you." But today, the sister's naked. And life is good. Life is real good. But, you know, you can live in the same house, but I'm not, if you got a mouth on you, If you hurt my feelings and you're disrespectful to me and you're sarcastic and you're critical and you won't take responsibility for it, you think my heart is a holy of holies and it's a sensitive place in all of us. All of us are more sensitive than we would want to admit. I cannot trust my heart of hearts to somebody who won't take responsibility for their behavior. When you're careful in the way that you treat each other, and when you take responsibility for your mistakes, the fig leaves come off. And when it says the man and his wife were both naked and unashamed, it meant mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically, they could talk about anything without shame. No shame. I'm not afraid in any way that you will reproach me because I trust you. You're my safe place. You're my safe place. So your spouse, we should be each other's safe place. Or I will be careful, and if I do something wrong, I'll take responsibility for it. But remember, blame transfer was the original sin of marriage. God came to Adam and said, "Adam, what is this that you've done?" He said, "It's her fault." "Eve, what is this that you've done?" "Devil made me do it." I honestly believe if they would have taken responsibility for their issues, that God would have had a different response to them.
This concludes session 2. Please continue with Understanding and Meeting Your Spouse's Needs, the next teaching in this series.